Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and he often tells me that the most complicated weather in the solar system is right here on Earth. And so I give a warm welcome to Dr. Tim Dowling.
Thank you very much. So my goal today is to bring you up to date on the latest Jupiter mission, the Juno mission, and also to open up the floor for any questions you might have about NASA's planetary science missions in general, things like that. I'm currently in the throes of writing a mission study for CubeSats. Raise your hand if you know what a CubeSat is. This is a little shoebox-sized satellite, of which Kentucky is on the map. We have one of the two CubeSat founders over at Morehead State University, Pooja Thong. He was at Stanford, and he came to Morehead. His name is Bob Twiggs. And the other one is a guy named Jordy Pugh. And NASA decided that they would like to look and see if every future mission, every 17 months there's a mission to Mars, every future mission to all the deep space targets should or should not have a little CubeSat mission added to it to supplement it. And so they realized that CubeSats have never flown in deep space. They've only flown in Earth out orbit. And we make a meal of them out of them here in Kentucky. St. Louis University does all these places, but they've been sort of toys to this point. So the question is, can you do it? Well, I'm deeply in the middle of a mission concept for putting some CubeSats around Mars in the 2022 orbiter mission. So it's not just from watching the Cubs and watching the election. I haven't had any sleep for about 2 weeks. So if I start to list, just, you know, say something to Jerry. But I'd like to show you some resources that you can actually get easily yourself about Juno in particular, since that's my first and greatest love is the giant planets, and particularly Jupiter. That's where I cut my teeth. So we're going to start with that. I'm going to actually show you something that humanity has never seen until the Juno mission. Now, you've heard, raise your hand, you've heard of phrases like music of the spheres, Holst. You've heard, that's literally music, right, of the planets, but of the music of the spheres and stuff, the planets being harmonic. We've known this for hundreds of years, but we've never actually seen it. You can see single planets, single moons. Galileo, back when telescopes were first invented, discovered that there were four moons around Jupiter, and it looked just like what we now would consider a solar system, but no one had actually seen it. Now, he made little sketches every night, and he could see that the little lights, the four little lights around Jupiter were moving, but he didn't see a movie of it. I'm going to show you a movie that Juno made, and this is the first time in human history we see multiple orbits at the same time. You see the celestial harmonics. So let me show you that. There's no sound from the speakers, is there? Just here. Let's see if we can fix that real quick. Since it might be me here. I don't know. Do you know if the HDMI connection does the? There is a one of these. Let me see if it will work. Yeah, I'm not getting them. All right, well, we can do it. The sound is not that important. So. Yeah, it's just, that'll be good enough. Okay, so, sorry to keep starting this over again, but it's not a long movie. Okay, so let me read it to you. Juno approach movie of Jupiter and the Galilean moons. These are actual photographs made into a movie. There's Jupiter coming into view. For millennia, Jupiter was but a wandering star. And this is now, of course, an artistic rendering of Galileo from the mid-1600s. For Galileo, a revelation. There they are. Congratulations, you're the first humans to see this, the first generation. You can't see the shadow of Jupiter from Earth. You can't see any of this. Look at the satellites as they go in and out of the orbit of Jupiter. But there it is. That's the music of the spheres right there. We've known about it for centuries. We've never seen it before. I want you to imagine every point of light in the sky with a dance around it, just like this. We basically don't have any objects that we're aware of that are missing this harmony. Sometimes it's planets, sometimes it's a disk. It's just incredible. For humanity, our first glimpse of celestial harmonic motion. It's amazing what we were able to do without this view, right? So that's been going on for over 4 billion years. The most reliable clock you've ever considered. This is a nice shot of the Juno spacecraft. Of course, it's a computer animation. Notice the rotation. Can you see that Juno is in the plane of the sun, of the day-night? Okay, that's enough of that for now. I want you to notice that was accurate. Juno is spinning, and it was in the plane of the day-night for Jupiter. So the sun side is day and the dark side. And there's a reason for that. It turns out Juno is quite ambitious in many engineering ways, in addition to scientific ways, which we're going to talk about tonight. But one of them is they decided, you know what? We're running out of plutonium. The United States has kicked bottoms in outer space for one reason and one reason alone. It's technical. We have more plutonium than the Russians. That's it. We are not better than them at hardware. We're about the same, but we have more plutonium than them. It's just the way things are. And some of that was made here in Kentucky, right? Over in the Paducah area. So there's a crisis in plutonium right now for outer planet research, and there's a big discussion at NASA about actually refining more. But you can see that's very expensive and politically fraught with all sorts of details. But anyway, that was the reason why, for example, the Russians specialized in Venus exploration in the 80s, and the U.S. did Voyager in the 80s, which gave us Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and then followed it with Galileo and Cassini. These are all deep space spacecraft that have a plug about this big of plutonium that is darned hot. It's so hot that, I mean, it's radioactive, but let's pretend like you've got some gloves on. You can't hold it. It's so hot. It just is hot. That's what it does. And they take that heat and use a thermocouple and produce electricity. It's not very efficient, but extraordinarily reliable. And there are no moving parts, and NASA loves putting things in spacecraft that have no moving parts because it's much less likely to break. But we're running out of plutonium. So Juno was designed to be a solar-powered mission at Jupiter. Jupiter is 5 times further from the sun than Earth is. Okay, you guys have all heard of the inverse square law. So take 5 and square it, 25, put it in the denominator, 1 over 25, that's 4%. So there is 4% sunlight at Jupiter compared to Earth. You have to have solar panels that much bigger, 25 times bigger. So if you were to take the Juno spacecraft and put it at the center of the Yum Center basketball court, you could literally dunk with the magnetometer beam. It's the size of the basketball court. And it's because of those solar arrays, and it's feeble. Now, there are some dirty secrets associated with that. They have no backup. If they lose the sun, they lose the mission. And this is a $1.1 billion mission. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the hiccups that have occurred in the last couple of months with the mission. The mission is full tilt. All the science is expected to be achieved, but they're not in the orbit they thought they were going to be in. Is everyone aware of that, or is that news? Most of you paid attention to some of that. I'll bring you up to date on some of that. There is, in about a year, an eclipse. In other words, the orbit they're in right now, which is a 53-day orbit, it's a perfectly good orbit to do science in, but it takes a lot longer than the original 14-day orbit that they were expecting to be in at this point, since August. Okay, so they could do all the science they're expecting, but at one point, as the Juno spacecraft slowly processes, naturally as part of its orbit, it's going to go into shadow of Jupiter, as we just saw the Galilean moons do, blink in, blink out. And this is not good, because Juno is not, it's not clear to the engineers who have spent the last 8 years of their lives with this thing, it's not clear that it can survive an eclipse. It's solar powered, and it may come out the other end, and we may not have contact with it anymore. So this is risky business. So I just wanted to let you in on some of these things that you don't hear about in the press. There's a lot of stress right now about, yes, we can do the science with the orbit we're stuck in at the moment, but there's an eclipse coming, and so they have to mitigate that. And that's something that doesn't have a solution yet. So just something to throw out. Let's look a little bit at some of the things that Juno is going to do or is in the middle of doing. This news, I will click on this in a minute. I want to show you the website that I'm going to use for this talk, for most of the talk. This is something you can get very quickly. You just type the four letters J-U-N-O and then S-W-R-I. This stands for Southwest Research Institute. This is the institution that is managing and designed Juno, and it's the home of the principal investigator, Scott Bolton. And so they have the website. So if you just do Juno SWIRI, that's how we say that, then everything I'm going to show you just pops right up. And they have an excellent website. This is the news, the most recent news. Juno exits safe mode. So there were two hiccups, and I want to start with that because that's on the sort of bad news side. Again, there's nothing, we've lost nothing yet, but we haven't gained a lot yet. Two hiccups. One is when they first went into orbit, that was July 4th. Does everyone remember that in the news? I mean, it's not hard to forget, July 4th. They had to do a very precise 30-minute burn of their main engine. And it was a lot of elements. There's exactly where it is when they burn, they have to do the stars, and they figure out exactly when to burn, and they estimate how long it's going to take because it turns off the engine based on where it is, not just the clock, and so all the parameters. And they got it to within a second, and it was awesome. It was absolutely perfect, spot on. And they got into exactly the right 53-day orbit they wanted, and that was the key. They got into orbit. This was the hardest orbit we have ever achieved because it's not just Jupiter orbit, which we've done before. You know, Mars was hard to get into orbit. But it's Jupiter orbit this way, where the sun is here. You had to come in at a really funny angle and get into orbit so that you're in the plane of the what we call the terminator, sun, not just this way, but polar and in this plane, a really tricky orbit. So they had to come back around the backside and get into an orbit like that, and they did it, spot on. And what they did was they had it basically in a one-hour burn to get to their 14-day orbit, and they did it in two parts. The first part was absolutely successful on July 4th. Yay, NASA is America's greatest brand, said the news. And then in October, after that first 53-day orbit, right at periaps, which is right when the spacecraft is closest to Jupiter, and as you've seen the news, it goes so close you could it's almost like the that when you start those movies, what is it, the DreamWorks, where the little boy is fishing? It's almost like that. You could just sort of trace your fingers through the water if Jupiter was the ocean. It's that close. It's amazingly close. It's every time I watch it, it's scary. I mean, it just basically goes right over the cloud tops, having come in from this huge orbit. That's when you want to do the burn. And so they were getting ready to do that, and they always test the valves. Obviously, the valves are very important for the rocket. And two of the main valves, which were supposed to open and close in 3 seconds, took 4 minutes. They did open and they did close, but they took 4 minutes, and they're supposed to take a few seconds. This is not good when you want the thing to turn off within a second's accuracy. So that freaked out the engineers, and so they decided not to do the burn. They're in orbit. It turns out, even though they have 30-some orbits planned and do all this redundant, awesome science, they only need 8. They only need 8 orbits to do all the science that's planned. And so the first one, instead of this burn in October, they decided, okay, we're going to stay in the long orbit, the 53-day orbit, and we'll do a science pass. That's the second hiccup. 10 hours before the science pass, I was in Pasadena at the Planetary Science Conference during that, it was that Thursday, just 2 weeks ago. 10 hours before it, the software decides to reboot and go into safe mode. And that's what is indicated here. I'll go back to this. This is the current latest press release. Juno exits safe mode, which is what happened, performs a trim maneuver. So let me just bring you up to date a little bit on that. So that was the second hiccup. We didn't get the science in that pass. We weren't expecting to. We were expecting to burn and go into the 14-day orbit. And literally, every other Wednesday was going to be science day. That was the plan. Every Wednesday, it was exactly every 2 weeks. They come in, you'd get the new data, you'd work on it, and do that for a whole year. So now it's not every second Wednesday, it's every 53 days. It's, well, how many, I mean, that's almost, you know, 2 months, not quite. So the next one is December 11th, and they haven't decided whether they're going to do a burn or not. Frankly, they want to get some science. And we would have, except for some reason it had a glitch, so we don't know why. This is common. This kind of thing is really common with a new spacecraft. So Juno has left safe mode and successfully completed a minor burn. That's not of the main rocket engines. They haven't turned those on again yet. It's the little thrusters that they have. And that they just do these little trims. Okay, so what I want to do now is go down and show you some of the things. Mostly I'm going to be forward. When we scheduled this talk, we expected that none of these problems would have happened and I'd be giving you first results. And I do have some results, including this one right here that's got all those words on it. This is actually a result. But what I want to mainly give you a sense of today, since we're obviously delayed, is what the instruments are on Jupiter, on Juno, and a little bit personal about what I'm interested in, have been for 30 years, and then a sense of some of the exciting things that we're going to be able to do. So a little bit too much forward thinking for my taste, but that's just where we are. Notice this picture here. See the stack? The top is a Voyager image, so that's your standard view of Jupiter. The white part here is the equator. And these brown parts, we call these belts. You can kind of remember like a brown belt, a belt around your waist. The white parts are called zones. And these are jet streams. Now the jet stream, the actual wind, the jet stream wind, is at the border between the color change. So every time the color changes, there is an incredibly fast jet stream there. And I mean by incredibly fast, over 200 miles an hour, where the jet streams on Earth, you know, 100. And on Jupiter, they can get up to 200, 250. On Saturn, they're even faster. So we get these really, really strong jets. And every time you see the color change, it's one right there, there's one right there, there's one right there. And then as you go up to higher latitudes, there are jet streams that are not associated with color changes. But we have all of this gorgeous stuff here. So this we've known since 1970s. That's actually when I got into planetary science, was when the Voyager data came in. Now I want to show you, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 little stacks there. This is actual data from the first pass, from the October pass, from what's called the microwave radiometer. The size of Juno, not the solar panels, but the size of the cube itself, was set to be exactly the right size to hold the largest of these antennas. These are microwave antennas, and the largest one is the one that measures the longest wavelength, and it sees the most deeply into the planet. So this is exaggerated in scale here, but this is several hundred miles into the planet, and that little striping you see down there is actual data. So what we're seeing, this is the first major result from Juno that we get, even on one pass, is look how deep the belt structure is. And look how it's changing as you go down. So there's going to be a lot of this data. This is one of the most exciting missions. I'm going to show you the principal investigator for the microwave radiometer and let him do the talking. But I just want to kind of get you excited about what's coming. The layers are full of data. The belts and zones go very deep into the planet. This is personal for me because in the 1980s and early 1990s, I was one of the few to predict that would be the case, that the belts and zones would be deep. So I'm extremely excited, almost to the point of being emotional about it, but you know, also frustrated because we've got to see all this data. So this is coming in right now. It's very exciting. All right, let's look at where I want to point you after this talk. If you have any interest in following up, go to here and go to the media gallery. So scroll down a little bit to the media gallery. This is where all the gems are. I'm going to have to bring this back up again because for some reason it's frozen, so let's do that. Okay, so if you go in here, there's all kinds of choices, all kinds of things that you can look at. We're only going to have time to do a couple of these here, but I just want to bring your attention to the Juno instruments, because one of the things I can do tonight and show you is the powerful instruments that we have on this spacecraft. Okay, each one of these is a different experiment. The atmosphere, the aurora, which is the northern lights, collisions, Earth flyby, these are just some details, etc. So what I'd first like to start off with you is, let me make this big. Where's the big? It must be this guy here, right? With probably the most novel experiment that we've got flying on Juno. This is the gravity experiment. And what they're doing is they put an ultra-stable oscillator on the Juno spacecraft. And they're going to uplink to the spacecraft a very pure sine wave signal so they can get ultra-pure Doppler shift. Little tiny, you know when an ambulance goes by, it goes, so it has that high to low pitch. That's the Doppler effect. High if it's coming towards you, low if it's going away from you, because it either compresses the waves or pulls them apart. The Doppler effect, I mean, that's what makes the door at Kroger's open up for you. It's not a big deal. But it's incredibly precise if your frequencies are like 1 part in 10 to the 11. Incredibly precise. And so with that, you get little tugs of Juno. I mean, really little tugs, little microgravity tugs towards the planet, away from the planet, having to do with the mass that's underneath and the density distribution. And this is just fantastic. Let me let the principal investigator himself tell you the story.
I've been asked, Dan, to help with the gravity science experiment. Measuring Jupiter's gravity depends on measuring changes in the spacecraft velocity that goes around Jupiter. What we're looking at are variations in that acceleration rate.
Gravity experiment. Okay, so what I'm going to do is sequence through some of these, and then I'm going to open the floor and we can start talking about anything you might happen to be interested in. I have certain personal biases which don't necessarily reflect everything else. Unless I'm skipping the auroral distributions one, I'll come back to that if we have some time. It's perfectly good science, I just don't know much about it. Energetic particle detector, JETI, got a cute name to it. Let me get down here to JunoCam. We're going to have the head of JunoCam, her name is Candy Hansen, give the Bullet Astronomy Lecture. Let's see, did Jerry just step out? That's in October next year, so almost exactly a year from now. So please look for that in October next year when they announce the Bullet Lecture. Candy Hansen, who's the head of the JunoCam instrument, will actually be here, not here, over at the planetarium in 1 year giving a talk on this. With lots of results by them.
JunoCam is on the spacecraft to take pictures of Jupiter, and we specifically designed it to get pictures of the polar regions of Jupiter. We've had a number of spacecraft that have flown past Jupiter and taken pictures, taken movies, but they've always been in the equatorial plane. And so this mission is the first one that we really get up over the polar regions. Let me mention that all of our pictures are of the cloud top. Jupiter is
Is LAS here?
Approximately a month away from when we take our data, we will be collecting the pictures from the amateur astronomy community and talk about why they would take a picture in any given latitude. And so the whole theme is to do science in a fishbowl. Let's do what we would do, but let's do it in a public forum so that the public can participate. And I'll be very happy if everybody gets involved the way I hope they do.
So look forward to that. Candy will be here next October giving the bullet lecture. Let me show you the magnetometer boom. Let's see. Oh, this is my favorite one. This is the microwave radiometer, the one that has those layers. And this will give you a good sense of this. Now, the gravity experiment, I would say, is the most innovative. This is what Scott Bolton thought of in the shower some 6 years ago. He's a colleague, a planetary science colleague in Austin, Texas, at Southwest Research. And he was frustrated from his career. He's very successful, but he was trying to think, how can we figure out the water content on Jupiter? After all these missions, we still don't know how much water is in Jupiter, and Jupiter's the biggest planet in the solar system. It's more mass than all the other planets combined. It formed first. It's incredibly important to know exactly how much water Jupiter has, because that tells you all kinds of things about the formation. For example, the leading theory of Jupiter is that it did not form in place. Now, when I was a graduate student in the 80s, the leading theory was different. It was called the snowball theory, which was that 5 astronomical units, where Jupiter is today, is right where snow becomes stable. A little too close, closer than that, like Earth is closer, then snow is volatile, it evaporates. A little farther away, then everything is snow, right on what we call the snow line. And so the idea was, well, Jupiter formed on the snow line. Well, that theory has been completely debunked. There's now a leading theory called the Nice theory, N-I-C-E, it looks like Nice, it's from the town in France. The Nice theory is now the leading theory, and the reason is some of the isotopes and some of the chemicals in Jupiter are too fragile and too hard to make at the temperature Jupiter is currently at. You have to be colder, significantly colder. And so the leading theories are saying that you know, a theory has to explain everything. You can't just explain 6 things and not explain the other 4, right? If it's going to be true, it has to explain everything. So it's easier to kill a theory than it is to support one. But these chemical arguments tell us that it's more likely that Jupiter actually formed where it was colder, and so these rare chemical species could actually form in the abundances that we see them spectroscopically. And then it migrated in. And so that is the hot topic, and it has been now for about 15 years, this idea of giant planets migrating. So what we need to do to really understand that and to basically understand the absolute fundamental questions about formation of the solar system, as you can imagine, a giant like Jupiter, it's kind of like, I don't know, just pick your favorite football player and having 4 or 5 people get through the line of defense and coming at you. It's a very scary thing to have this enormous planet coming into the inner solar system. It sweeps out all the asteroids, it makes a big mess, and it can either hurt or harm you, harm or help you, depending on what you're trying to do. But anyway, it's a huge perturbation. So figuring out the water, as you'll hear here, is critical. And it's critical also for the chemistry, for everything we are trying to figure out. And Frank, where's the water in your mouth come from? That's actually a mystery right now. It turns out you can get a fingerprint for water, so to speak. You can get an attribute of water that's extraordinarily difficult to change over billions of years, and that is the ratio of the deuterium to the hydrogen. Deuterium, like Deuteronomy, means 2. Deuteronomy's second law. Deuterium means 2. So it's basically, instead of a proton and an electron, for the simplest atom, hydrogen, it's a proton and a neutron and an electron. So it's twice the weight. It makes what's called heavy water. We have a little bit of deuterium all over. We have H2O, everyone, but we have also HDO. In other words, a hydrogen, a deuterium. And that comes about one part in about 10,000, something like that. But the exact ratio, it's called the D to H ratio, and we say it in planetary science, we say D to H ratio, like it's one word. The D to H ratio is incredibly important. It's incredibly hard to change. Regular chemistry over millions of years does not change the D to H ratio of a liter of water, no matter what happens to the water. Boil it, freeze it, whatever, you can't change the D. So it's a signature. The D to H ratio on Earth is about 16 in the units that are used. It's called standard mean ocean water, SMO. That's the D to H ratio in your mouth. And so we say, oh, well, we'll just look at the comets. So the comets come whizzing by, and this is David Pruitt about 30 years ago. He's at Hawaii. He just started measuring the HDO to H2O ratio, which is the D to H ratio, of these comets spectroscopically, and he got 32, 34, 30, nowhere near 16. So the water for Earth, which is in your mouth right now, we don't know where it came from. So now they've just made a meal out of this, and they've been looking at the D to H ratio for water everywhere in the solar system. Where the heck did the Earth's water come from? Did it come externally from a comet late in the formation of Earth? Was it locked up in the planetesimals that formed Earth and just sort of outgassed from the volcanoes, a little of both? But we can't find it. Until just a couple of years ago, one of the satellites, one of the little asteroids that's an icy asteroid in the Jupiter family, they measured the D to H ratio and it came out to be 16. Oh my goodness. And there are some meteorites that have been broken off of this thing and have come down to us. And so it looks like it might just be a single massive influx from one unusual object in Jupiter orbit, and not just, you know, comets from anywhere, from the Oort cloud, from anywhere. It's just, we're starting to actually, it's getting personal. You get a chill and you think about the, you know, because all these things are important for us to be here. But the water that actually came here to Earth may have come in a very, very interesting way that we can start to piece together. So the microwave radiometer on Juno, this is a long way of introducing it, but it's going to get right at that. That's what Scott Bolton wanted. He's in the shower 6 years ago, and it hits his forehead in the shower. This is how he tells the story, and he realized he could figure out how to do it. That's this instrument. The rest of Juno was all built around that, but this was the original concept. Okay. Now we're going to get a little more esoteric. I'm biased towards things you can see. I'm very visual. But I have a lot of colleagues who spend their whole career on invisible stuff. They get all juiced up about magnetospheres, electromagnetic waves, and things like that. And so let's see a little discourse on waves.
Looks like
Gyram?
Infrared.
So this was an example of an instrument that was added later. You might notice with Juno, every time they show a picture of the heart of it, that there's this big cube. And you may have seen in the news that the cube is actually made out of titanium. It's literally a titanium vault. And the reason is because there's a million amp current between Io and Jupiter. Million amp current. It's the harshest, it's like being fricasseed. It's the harshest radiation environment anywhere in the solar system. And we're flying right next to it, not through the harshest, because that would actually fry the spacecraft. But we're flying right next to it every time we have a close encounter. Really close. And in fact, the first encounter, the very first one where they did the big burn to get into the to orbit, they actually had several bit flips, single instant bit flips, where they had to use the error correcting code, which you have in your phone, ECC code, to actually fix those. But they are keeping track of those, because that's what sets the duration of this mission, is those radiation doses over and over again. And so they want, it's a game between getting science done as quickly as possible before the electronics is literally fried. And NASA has never put, would never dream of putting instruments this sensitive in an environment that crazily harsh unless there was a good reason. And so that's sort of where some of the urgency comes from. And now that we're in these 53-day orbits, it's a little bit stressful because it's going to take longer to get that. Okay, well, there's one more here. We're going to do the Jupiter Energetic Particle Detector. Then I'm going to show you some of the early results, in particular from the microwave radiometer and also from the Gyram. But let's look at this one, and then we'll switch to that. If you could see the magnetic field of Jupiter, it's the largest object in the solar system, much bigger than the sun, much, much bigger. If you could see it in the sky, it's the size of the full moon. So you know Jupiter's a very big, bright star.
Put the full moon right there. That's the size of the magnetosphere. It's so huge, Saturn, which is 9 astronomical units away, almost twice as far as Jupiter, passes through Jupiter's magnetotail. In fact, that happened when Voyager was at Saturn back in 1981. Saturn was, just by luck, was passing through Jupiter's magnetotail at that moment. So it's an enormous structure, and that's what this is looking for. So let me now cut to some of the early, very early results that we've got. Let's see. I don't like it when it does that. I'm going to kill it and bring it back up again. You think with $1.1 million they'd get a better website that doesn't do that, but they didn't spend the money on the website. Okay, so this is an unfettered image that I was showing you. This is from the microwave radiometer showing the different belts all the way down to about 200 miles depth. And you can see the structure is there. It's changing with each layer. And there's a lot more to come on that one. That's, for me, was sort of the most emotional one to see, because it is starting to look like I was right about the deep jets. Looking for their... The other website that you can look at is just the NASA one. This is a pretty cool, let me go back to this. This is, just want to blow this up for a second here. This is now history because it didn't happen. There's still a possibility it might. I'm not zooming it very well, but anyway, I just want to draw your attention to this little graphic down here. That was the original design, and you can see it's incredible. There's a grid that is patiently over every 14 days laid out. Now, they're still possibly going to be able to get to that, but like I said, they don't need to. So we're right now, they're happy. Scott Bolton was at the meeting 2 weeks ago giving his report to the whole, you know, 1,200. It was a combined U.S.-European meeting, and he was very stressed out, you could tell. But he's happy in a sense they're in orbit. That was the key thing. And they could do all this, but it's not going to be this incredible grid, at least at first. Now, of all these 37 wonderful orbits, you only need 8, as I said earlier, to actually do almost all of the science. So I wanted to get to some of the latest, some of the results themselves. Here we go. This was one of the first images that was it's just a kind of a boring Jupiter image, unless you realize that you can't get that shot from Earth. And then we made that movie that I showed at the beginning. Now it's doing its thing again. Hold on, just be patient, please. Okay, so I'm going to look at these are the northern lights of Jupiter. We had never seen the South Pole northern lights until Juno, until just recently. The north we could see, but we didn't even know if it had south lights. If you listen very carefully to the guy talking about the magnetosphere, Aurora, he said, if.
And now we see them. We have these awesome, awesome views. So Fran Baganal and all her colleagues at the University of Colorado in Boulder are just beside themselves. Absolutely ecstatic because of the, they've never had these views. Do you see those little bright dots? Let me see if I can stop this for a second. You see the arches? I'm going to bring it back just a little bit and point out a feature here. Okay, let me stop it. Come on. Let me draw your attention to that little spot right there. That's called a footprint. Another footprint. These are literally the burn marks of the current that's coming from the Galilean satellite. There's four Galilean satellites. We saw that at the beginning of the talk. And those currents, the biggest one is Io, come in through space and just burn a hole right in the atmosphere of Jupiter, right at the pole, both the North Pole and the South Pole. Those are called the footprints. I think this is the Io footprint. Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto are the four of them. Incredible. So there's a million amp current running from here to here. And of course, they do not send the spacecraft through that or near it. But they're going to have to get kind of close towards the end of the mission. So this is not pretty with music. This is just raw data that have started to be processed. So yes, indeed, Jupiter does have southern lights. I guess we would call it aurora australis. They're fantastic. It's just that we never could see them from Earth, and now we've got gorgeous views of them. Now, Jupiter, the Juno spacecraft, see that blue fuzz right at the top there? See that? It's flying there. That's how close the spacecraft gets to Jupiter, is right on the top of that fuzz when it goes through. It just gives me the willies every time I see it. They're making a really cool movie, by the way, of this. A couple of years ago for the Bullitt Lecture, we had Linda Spilker. Did anyone come to that? Anyone here? LAS guys or anybody? Linda Spilker is the head of the Cassini Imaging. And she gave, and she gave a wonderful talk. The Cassini mission has been going on since 2004, so it's in its 12th year. It's going to be decommissioned next year. They're going to do a Juno-like end to the Cassini mission. They're going to fly in these close polar orbits for Saturn with the Cassini mission and get this incredible, and instead of, they're going to get the gravity data just like Juno, but they're going to get this incredible view. It's almost like you're on the bridge of the Star Trek Enterprise flying through the rings of Saturn, actually inside the rings of Saturn between the planet and the rings. Just like that, and it's going to be a lurch to actually watch that movie. So that's going to be made starting in April. Something to look forward to. Okay, I'm just about done with the things that I desperately wanted to show you. This is all the aurora stuff. Let me just open up the floor. Is there any of these topics here, because we could go on and on, any of the students in particular are interested in? I tend to have a bias towards the visual stuff. Everyone's sort of like, who's getting extra credit? Yeah, you guys don't count. Okay, the people who aren't getting extra credit.
I have a question. You were talking about the crust, and you were talking about the valves.
Yes, the stuck, the sort of, right. Let me turn the light on so we can. So basically the answer is yes. They think if they can figure out why the valves are sticky, if they can fix it, there's two parts. One is to figure out why they're sticky, because that's not expected. And the second one is, can you fix it? And sometimes they can. If they can fix it, they will do a test burn, a short test burn, and then they will try to do the 30-minute burn and get into the 14-day orbit. Scott Bolton is leaning towards not doing that first. Let's go ahead and just get the science. We're in an orbit. It's just instead of every other Wednesday, we have to wait every 2 months, but we're going to get the data. So let's say it's so much safer. I mean, you can tell he doesn't eat when he thinks about this $1.1 billion mission, which is in orbit with all the instruments working, having this, all they have to do is burn the rocket and have it not turn off on the right moment and lose it. They can't. even concept like that. So it's very critical. If they get to the point where they understand it, yes. Engineers are not shy. They're not superstitious. If they actually understand why it's sticking and they know it's not sticking, they will do it. That rocket is really well built. It's actually a British rocket. It's very well built. It's just that something about the cold environment that they're in. But yes, why is the mission exactly 37 orbits? Why is it a year? It turns out that's just the radiation. They know for sure. They go through. You're getting about 1 million dental x-rays. 1 million dental x-rays is what this thing is getting. So it's guaranteed that it's going to fail. So they know it's going to fail. So they can't. There's a thing called a planetary protection. There's a guy whose job is cooler than President of the United States. He's called the Planetary Protection Officer. The job came open a couple of years ago. It was really funny to see the ad for it. This is a person that works for NASA who has no boss. He's the Planetary Protection Officer, and he vetoes or gives the thumbs up to every mission, and his job is to make sure that we as a human species do not contaminate any world that possibly could have life on it on its own, in particular Europa, Mars, and so they have to sterilize every spacecraft, and they have to have a sterilization plan. And Jupiter has these moons that we started to talk with, in particular Europa, which we know for a fact has a briny ocean. Basically, almost entire inside is liquid briny salt. It has the liquid water. You need that. It has the energy source. It has. If we put Earth microbes there, they would live. On Mars as well, but especially on Europa. So we want to go. If we go in 50 years with a big Europa lander like it's being planned, both by the U.S. and Europeans, and we say, oh, we found microbes, and someone says, yeah, but Juno accidentally ran into and hit Europa, you know, 3 decades ago, so you guys don't have nothing. You contaminated it. So they have this planetary protection officer, and he says yes or no to every mission. The little mission I'm planning right now, we have to sanitize the two CubeSats. We have to have a way to make sure they burn up, that we leave enough propellant to be able to put them into a kamikaze orbit so that they burn up. So we have to have that sanitation thing. So it's really interesting. It's kind of a cool, funny little fact that we have that guy. But once his decision is made, the President of the United States, nobody can overturn it. So he has that authority, which is really kind of interesting. So Juno has to be sanitized, and they have to do it before it runs out of propellant, which is not hard because they always carry plenty of propellant hydrazine. But it also has to run out before it loses its circuits. And so that's what the main thing is. So it's a race against time right now to get the science to make sure that we don't burn the an unreliable rocket that has unreliable... It's a reliable rocket with an unreliable valve. But if they get that, there's a second hiccup, and that hiccup is when they went into this orbit in the close flyby in October, just before, 10 hours before, they went into the safe mode. You know, and poor Scott, he comes to the meeting, the encounter was on Thursday of a week-long meeting. And so on Wednesday, he thought he had a talk with, 1,400 planetary scientists, and he had to get up in front of all of us, like I am in front of you, and say, we went into safe mode, and we don't know why. So this is typical of spacecraft at their first couple of passes. Almost every spacecraft has one of these. It's software. Basically, you've got software running on a machine that's never happened before. You know, we do our proof of concept by actually flying these things, right? And so they do as many tests as they possibly can with the software and the hardware, but it's hypersensitive. And so they will go into safe mode, which means that they're pointing to the sun, and they turn the instruments off, and they just go, something's wrong. And it just goes like that. It's totally safe. They don't know what's wrong, so they turn everything off, except they put it in the safe mode. They have a little star tracker, literally a little tube that has certain stars, and they lock it in. And it went into that mode 10 hours before the encounter. All the instruments get turned off. So we went right around Jupiter, and you go by Jupiter whether you're ready or not, right? You go by. It's just no control of that. And we didn't get anything, so... we don't know why it went into safe mode. I haven't heard. I asked my colleagues just before this talk. They still don't know. They're studying. I think they do know, but they need to, NASA's unbelievably conservative. They will not tell you unless they are certain. And so, but the nice thing with 53 days is that's plenty of time to figure it out. So they will more than likely know why it did that and not have it happen again. That's my prediction. What type of
fuel gauge?
It has different kinds of fuel, and so it has the big rocket, the one that has one more roll, which is a 30-minute burn, which may or may not happen. And then it has these little hydrazine tanks, and so they
purposefully, I just mentioned Cassini. Cassini has been in orbit for 12 years, since 2004, and it still has enough, it's had, I don't know, 60 or 70 different orbits, so it has enough to keep going. But they just basically decided it's getting old, and they need to sterilize these things before they run out. So, you know, do you fix the roof when it's not raining? Who cares? You don't need to do that. And when it's raining, you can't fix it, right? So they make sure that they fix it before the rain comes, that they do it before the gauge comes out. But there are, to answer your question, there are there's the main rocket, which sort of sits there and has its role, but the more important one during the science operations phase are these little hydrogen tanks. And they just, they're literally just the little thrusters. There's like 12 of them. And they just, very precise. The same thing as in your car. I mean, they're just little electric strips to tell how much hydrogen is in the tanks. Yeah, and they know exactly how much they have. They also know how much they burned. I mean, there are engineers that they spend their entire career on these things. For the Mars missions, Mars has a day that's almost the same as Earth, 24 hours and a little bit. 24 hours, it's like 40 minutes extra. So for 1 or 2 days, that's about right. But you know, it walks, right? So after a couple of weeks, day here is night there, and it keeps walking. So Steve Squires at Cornell and the other guys, they have these specially made watches that are on Mars time. And during the missions, especially in the first year of the missions, the most critical part, they actually just stay on Mars time. And so, you know, it's the ultimate third shift, right? It just keeps sort of rotating around and around. So, any questions on, yeah?
Can you talk a little bit about the
D to H, right. Well, if you have a lot of deuterium, you have what's called heavy water, which, for example, some nuclear reactors are designed to use heavy water because it damps the radiation a little better. My dad was actually a nuclear engineer back in the 60s and 70s, so I've heard some of that stuff. But for the most part, there isn't a whole lot of nuclei that have, instead of just a single proton, have the extra neutron to make it twice as heavy. The neutron, remember, has no charge. So the chemistry that you associate with any chemical is the electron. And so you keep the one electron, but you've added a second weighty particle next to the proton. The neutron is almost exactly the same weight as the proton. So you doubled the weight of that atom. But like I said, there's only about one part in 10 to the thousand that's actually got that. But it's very easy to measure because of the slight mass difference when they look at the spectroscopy. Now, the way that's done is the water molecule spins. And it spins faster or slower when these photons come in. It can make it spin fast. That's how a microwave oven works. So the hot dog or anything, you notice with the microwave oven, it famously will not heat up something that doesn't have any water in it, like Tupperware. Doesn't get hot. It only gets hot because of water. But things like a hot dog that has a lot of water in it, something like a hot dog heats up really fast and you could kill it. Right. So that's just all that's doing is the microwave is just spinning the water molecules. And that makes them energetic, and they end up hitting everything else, and that heats up the rest of the food. So this is the same kind of thing happening here. Was there another part?
Well, I was wondering what difference does it make? I mean, especially in identifying
right, so,
where the water came from.
So you can very precisely, so the opposite of heating up the water is just listening to the water with your microwave eyes. And that's what the microwave radiometer is doing. And so you can get, because the HDO is heavier, all of its spectral lines, these are all of the special energy levels that it can spin at. Quantized. So it can spin this fast or twice as fast or three times as fast. Those are shifted relative to H2O. And you can see that. That's what these microwave radiometers do. So they just can see that, and they can also see by the strength of the lines how much HDO there is. And so that very precise ratio is done extremely well, and that gives you the D to H ratio. Now they could do that. They're going to do it crazy good for Jupiter, but they could do it for comets. They could do it for asteroids, anything that flies by. They get the D to H ratio. People make a cottage industry out of it. And so we have a map of the D to H ratio through the solar system. And and the reason I'm all excited about and I'm trying to impress upon you why it's important, is you can't change it. You have to basically have a star explode, nuclear chemistry, which is extremely difficult to do unless you're doing it on purpose like a human, or if you have a sun explode. Very hard to change. There are other things like isotope ratios that are famously very difficult to change. They're used for how in the world can you measure something that's a billion years old? You use these radioisotopes that are very stable.
But D to H is just the one for water that's really important. And again, like I said, we did not have a D to H ratio that matched standard mean ocean water, SMO, until just recently. It was amazing. I mean, the comets were 32, and then everyone said, okay, the comets are double the Earth ones, so they're not comets. And then they found some other near-Earth objects that came by, and they didn't match. They were in the, like, 8. They were too low. And where the heck did the water in your mouth come from? I mean, it's starting to get ridiculous. And then now we have exactly one candidate, this big icy asteroid that's in the Jupiter system. And by the way, there's a Discovery-class mission that's going to that. To that asteroid, and there's a plan to land on it. I mean, we're all excited about it because that's where your spit came from. That one, that, I mean, isn't that cool? So that may not be the true story, but it's part of it, and it's just it's almost like CSI solar system, right? So it's trying to basically do forensics on something as important as the water. You'll notice that every single aspect of the Earth-Moon system is related to being beneficial to life. Clearly water is, all these things are. So that's kind of the underlying motivation for all these. Is there any questions over here? You guys just getting extra credit and just kind of falling asleep? Come on. I would encourage you, just for fun, you know, you're always encouraged to vote. Hopefully you did that. But there's another vote that you can make. Get onto Candy Hansen's website, JunoCam, and you can vote for the images that are going to be taken over the next year. And of course, it'll be one vote among millions, but please do it. You'll have influenced where they point that camera. So that's what that camera's for. I was mentioning earlier, there's two instruments on Juno that are outside the titanium cage. One is JunoCam because, you know, they didn't have enough data rate to do the movies they like to do, so they made it into this really cool, it's a very good camera, but it just is being used for the purpose as described. The other one is that very late instrument that was just described that got stuck on, literally glued onto the outside of the titanium casing. Everything else is inside the casing, except for the little detector parts that hang out.
What's the question
afterwards?
Yeah, we can finish. Okay, so let's thank Tim Dowling for his talk. We also, not for students, but if you would like to make a contribution to help astronomy in our department, be a Jupiter researcher, or something like that, we'll be happy to take donations of any kind of wonderful help, or whatever we can give you for teaching if you like, or if you want to write a check, back to the office. So thank you again for coming, and we can take you down here for more questions.
Can I get the slides tomorrow?